Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host. I am delighted to be escorting you about the battle space of the war of ideas with some of the best in the business. We'll be visiting momentarily with Clifford May of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He is going to give us a sense of how that's going, defending democracies around the world and freedom more generally. We'll be talking in segment two with Barry Rubin about what it means that Turkey is going to, if not to the dogs, to the Islamists for sure, and the mistakes the administration here in the United States is making in misunderstanding the threat of the Muslim Brotherhood. We'll be visiting in segment three with Senator Jim DeMint about an important new book about the Great American Awakening. And finally, Gordon Chang will be joining us to talk about what's been going on in Asia lately, the Vice President's visit there this week, and what might come of it, what might come of other developments at the hands of our Chinese friends. So all of that straight ahead. But first, we've got Clifford May, frequent guest, I'm happy to say, and very valued colleague at the Foundation for Defense of Democracy. Cliff, you have been writing about a number of things that are of great relevance to the sort of subject I wanted to talk with you about, which is kind of a state of the world, or the state of the free world, at least. You've noted in a recent piece at National Review Online that we are borrowing from the communists and we are paying the jihadists. That's one particular manifestation of the problem. But let's talk a little bit about how we are at the moment positioned vis-a-vis developments. Let's start with Iran that are greatly portentous. You've been working on sanctions against the regime there. What is happening and what are the prospects?
Well, look, Frank, good to be with you. What's going on with Iran is there's nothing hopeful. I mean, Iran continues to kill Americans in Afghanistan, and Iran and collaborate with al-Qaeda and other groups, the Taliban, Hezbollah, of course, it is the patron of, and Hamas. Now, what's interesting there is people like you and I have been noting this for years. Michael Ledeen, who works here, has been saying it. Tom Joslin has been documented. Only a week ago, the U.S. government finally acknowledged that indeed we do know that Iran is working with terrorist organizations, including not least al-Qaeda, and has been for years, facilitating the murder of Americans in Iraq and Afghanistan, and of course going back to 1983 in Beirut. Now, we have what was sad about that is at the end of a statement by the U.S. government that Iran is killing Americans, there was no statement of what we're going to do in response. Meanwhile, in addition to continuing to build weapons of mass destruction, by which I mean particularly nuclear and missiles to deliver them, we also have an Iranian who is commander in the Revolutionary Guard Corps, who is himself under sanctions, Rustam Qasimi, who will be the next president of OPEC. And he will be, even though he's under sanctions and theoretically prohibited from visiting Europe, he will be able to go to Europe because of the loophole, because he's visiting an international organization. That organization is OPEC, a cartel, a conspiracy and restraint of trade, and he will try, while he is there, to squeeze every drop of money out of Americans and Europeans he can so they can use that money for terrorism and the development of nuclear weapons and missiles. And we are, in the West, doing nothing about any of this.
Yeah. Profoundly troubling. Let's talk a little bit about the Russian reset that the administration has ballyhooed since coming to office. Cliff May, we've been told that, among other things, that Vladimir Putin is doing seemingly as part of his presidential campaign in the offing, in terms of, you know, rubbing our noses and things, is a recent bomb blast outside of the U.S. Embassy in Georgia that is attributed to the handiwork of one of Russian military intelligence officers deployed in the area. How is this going, Cliff, in terms of the threat that we may face in the future from Russia and its management by the United States at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, Russia is a very disappointing case. I spent a lot of time in the old Soviet Union. I was very pleased to see it collapse, to see the Berlin Wall fall. But under Vladimir Putin and Dmitry Medvedev, what we're seeing is a sort of a neo-Sovietism. Russia, I don't think, is going to attack us, but it is. But what Russia is doing is facilitating and empowering all those who can diminish us. So Russia has become the strategic ally of Iran. A very strange thing to do in a way. You would think that Russia would not want a nuclear-armed Iran on its border, but I think Putin figures the missiles are not going to be pointed at us. They wouldn't dare. This is going to hurt the U.S., and anything that hurts the U.S., Russia thinks is good for Russia. The Russian feelings, as expressed by Putin, they regret the end of the Soviet Union and the loss of the power they once had, and they seek to regain it, and they're doing that by essentially aligning themselves with any authoritarian regime that's anti-American. And so the idea of resetting with Russia, as if it were our fault that we had bad relations, I think that theory has been proven wrong.
Yeah. We're speaking with Clifford May of the Foundation for Defense of Democracy. He is its president and a frequent contributor to the public policy debate through its good work and also through his writings for Scripps Howard, syndicated columnist, and National Review Online. Cliff, just to round this out very quickly, we were going to talk a bit more about this with Gordon Chang at the bottom of the show, China and its emergence increasingly as a global rival to the United States. How does that seem to you to be playing out? Is it, in fact, a threat?
Well, yeah, it's a different sort of threat, but I think it's a real irony, and it should be seen as a foreign policy problem, that as we pay historic amounts of money, we're transferring historic amounts of wealth to the Middle East, to, and when I say we, I mean the entire West. Wealth to Saudi Arabia, wealth to Iran, wealth to Venezuela. We have to borrow enormous amounts of money in order to cover that, and a tremendous amount of that borrowing is from China. Now, I think China seeks to diminish us at this point rather than destroy us. We're too important a customer, too important a lender. But as we cut our military, which is what we may very well be doing, you're fighting that, I know. I'm hoping that's not the case, and we'll work against that. China will take the money, the servicing on the debt that we owe them, and I don't think it'll use it for No Child Left Behind programs. I don't think it'll use it for health care. I think it'll use it to expand the Chinese military in order to have the freedom it wants initially in Asia, and then perhaps even beyond. China is interested in China's interests only. It has no global view of any sort that we can see. It's amoral in most things. And we're not taking that seriously. We need to stop spending so much money in the Middle East, and we need to stop borrowing so much money from China.
Yeah. Cliff May, let me just then, having just gotten basically a very important but sort of short course on challenges that we're facing around the world, ask you to drill down on your point about the budget cuts that now seem in prospect. We'll be speaking momentarily with Senator Jim DeMint about this, but I'd like to get your sense of, as a foreign policy practitioner and expert, what it means if the United States, in fact, cannot afford to have the kind of presence and power projection and mission capabilities that we've been accustomed to for many years now.
It's detrimental to us and detrimental to the world. We need to be a great power, and a great power economically, in order to be a great power militarily, in order to be a world leader. We can't do that if we were a debtor nation cutting our military and losing, falling back economically, which is what is predicted right now. If we're not growing economically, we're falling back economically. You don't just stand still. You got to think, when Britain decided to give up its empire after World War II and decided to, it was no longer going to be a global leader, it could hand over to the United States. Who are we going to hand over to? Are we going to hand over to Tehran, to Russia, to China, to the United Nations, and to other international organizations? It's a very bad idea. We need to be strong economically, and that means we need to restore economic dynamism. And to restore economic dynamism, that's going to be a long conversation, obviously, but most of all, we need to have policies that encourage economic growth, that encourage entrepreneurs and innovators and investors and workers to say it's worth it to put in to take risks and work hard and to move this economy forward. That means we need a government that's less interventionist and that leaves more room for initiative and creativity than we have right now. I think our economic problems are curable. When Ronald Reagan took over as president, we had stagflation. We had hostages in Iran. We had a terrible situation. He turned it around in a few years. It can be done again. I hope that is what happens, whoever the next president is.
Well, I hope so, too, and I hope it will not be made much more difficult by having weakened ourselves to the point where many of those very, very sensible nostrums are essentially inoperable because we cannot operate in the world as we need to. Puf May, you're doing your part to try to prevent that from happening. Thank you for your leadership at the Foundation for Defense of Democracy. Thank you for joining us here at Secure Freedom Radio. We look forward to talking with you again soon. Next up, Barry Rubin reads us in on what is going on in Turkey with the purge of the military and the equally troubling attitude of the U.S. government towards the Muslim Brotherhood. Straight ahead.
Peace through strength with Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
I was able to lose the 80 pounds I gained due to pregnancy. It was pretty easy to eat whatever I wanted and not think about it.
The Meta System from Judy Singer has been helping make weight loss easier for a quarter century.
My husband's grandmother used it 20 years ago to lose weight for a wedding and said it was the only way to go.
The Meta System also has an excellent support staff.
They were very supportive. The first time that I ordered the product, they called me and suggested that I order a lower dosage to begin with. They didn't want me to jump the gun right off the bat, and it was nice to know that they actually cared.
And the weight loss is so dramatic, people wonder.
With the Meta System, I've got many questions about how I managed raising a baby and working full-time and lose the weight and eat whatever I wanted.
People who use it recommend it.
I suggested the Meta System to my mother, and she has lost 30 pounds.
Learn more about weight loss with Judy Singer's The Meta System by calling 800-711-JUDY, 800-711-JUDY. The Meta System from Judy Singer, the powerful all-natural way to lose weight, 800-711-JUDY.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
It could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by Barry Rubin. He is the director of the Global Research in International Affairs Center, better known by its acronym GLORIA in Israel. He is the author of numerous books, including The Israel Arab Reader and The Long War for Freedom, The Arab Struggle for Democracy in the Middle East. Barry, let's talk a little bit about a struggle for freedom sort of in the area, I guess immediately adjacent to the Middle East, but with very significant implications for the Middle East, namely what is going on in Turkey at the moment. There seems to have been a purge of the military. Is there any remaining check on what seems to be the decidedly Islamist thrust of the Erdogan government there?
Well, that's an easy question answer, and the answer is no. The Erdogan government, which I call a stealth Islamist government, has systematically taken over, destroyed, challenged every institution in Turkey, including the media, which they own 30%, and intimidated much of the rest, the court system, the educational system, and finally the army. The heads of the top four officers resigned, We now know why they resigned, because they knew that the government was planning widespread arrests of senior officers on trumped-up charges, and the Army is helpless to do anything about it. So this is a major additional step toward the fundamental transformation of Turkey into a semi-Islamist or Islamist state.
Yeah, I am struck by the fact that this is happening with very little attention being paid, certainly here in the United States, to it. Indeed, to the extent that people are following developments in Turkey at all, I think there is a continuing misapprehension that we are dealing with a democratically elected government, one that that has supported, you know, economic progress and is, yes, sort of vaguely Islamist, but not really acting in a manner that is problematic from the point of view of, say, NATO or U.S. interests or those of the free world more generally. And how would you respond to that misapprehension?
Right. Well, first of all, part of it is just outdated, because they look back at the old Kemalist Republic of Turkey, which existed from the 1920s until, you know, fairly recently, but that's simply not the situation. Things have changed. The second problem is the insistence in seeing Turkey as a model of moderate Islamists who are taking power and respecting democracy. The problem is it is a model, but it's a model of Islamists who use relatively moderate and step-by-step tactics to gain the same ends. And inasmuch as the Turkish model is being studied by groups like the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood, it's being studied on how to take over a country without not only without arousing suspicion and hostility in the West, but actually getting Western and certainly U.S. support. If you look at the WikiLeaks from the U.S. Embassy in Turkey, you find that the reporting is actually quite good, that the embassy reporting shows that there is a high degree of understanding there and warnings. The problem is in the White House,
yeah,
particularly.
Well, I'm worrying about this a great deal myself from the White House's conduct towards the Muslim Brotherhood, both in Egypt, where, as you say, we I think have reason to believe that it is following, if not exactly the Turkish model, maybe an even more accelerated bid for power through the ballot box. But also, Barry, let me just ask you to comment on both the Egyptian situation, the spectacle of Hosni Mubarak, our longtime friend, in a cage in a courtroom now, but also the folly of the United States government actually embracing Muslim Brotherhood front organizations here in the United States.
I think very few people understand the theory underlying the administration's policy. It's very clear point of view. And this point of view is Al-Qaeda are very bad people, and they're radical Islamists, and they're terrorists. And the problem is they want to attack the United States directly. But all the other groups are not groups you can moderate them, you can deal with them, and that includes the Muslim Brotherhood, even to some extent the Taliban, Hezbollah, and of course Iran and Syria, who are sponsors of terrorism, and although they're somewhat limited by domestic opposition, Hamas as well. And so they believe that these people can be moderated, you can deal with them, and at least, as I say, they're not going to attack the World Trade Center. And that really is the underlying viewpoint that shapes American policy. Turning to Egypt, one of the most amazing things I've ever dealt with in more than 30 years of studying and analyzing the Middle East is the difficulty in getting across to people the rather obvious point that the Muslim Brotherhood is and has always been an extremely radical organization. And it's amazing that one cannot really get this into the mass media. All you have to do is read the speeches of the leaders, read what they write in their publications. I mean, except for their English language site, which is deliberately designed for propaganda. I mean, nothing could be more obvious. And these people want to take state power. Now, sometime in November afterward, there will be elections in Egypt. I don't think that the Muslim Brotherhood is going to win a majority in parliament, but I think they're going to be the largest single bloc at a minimum 30% of the seats, maybe as high as 40%. They will be able to ally with certain independents and others. They will have a major role in shaping the constitution of Egypt and in conducting, running their country. They want to take over the religious institutions. This is the biggest threat to U.S. National security, certainly in the Middle East since the Iranian Revolution. And it's very difficult to get people to recognize this. If I can give you one, like, truly amazing example.
Barry, I just want to make sure the audience knows who is the source of this profound wisdom on the Muslim Brotherhood and its true character and the threat that it poses to us in Egypt, elsewhere in the region, and for that matter here at home. Among other reasons, you are an authority on the subject, Barry Rubin, as the director of the Global Research and International Affairs Center, but also as the author of The Muslim Brotherhood, the Organization and Policies of a Global Islamist Movement. So pick up with your anecdote, please.
So there were three polls, and the polls said that 17% of the people polled said they would vote for the Muslim Brotherhood. And so this was picked up and ridiculed in a lot of prestigious Western media organs. Oh, only 17%, so they have no real base of support, they're not any threat. Well, in fact, the problem was that 40% of the people polled did not express an opinion or supported very small marginal parties that wouldn't get seats. When you analyze the poll, what you find is that about one-third of those who identified a party that they were going to vote for that was a realistic chance of getting seats supported the Muslim Brotherhood. So that's one out of every three Egyptian voters identified that as the party they would support. And not a single, basically, organ of the mass media pointed out that that's, you know, how that poll should be interpreted. So the first line of denial is they're not a threat. The second line of denial is they're not going to be important. And the third line of denial is the Muslim Brotherhood are good guys because they're protecting Egypt from the really radical groups, which are now called Salafist groups. In fact, the Muslim Brotherhood, I mean, people in Cairo know this. They're working with these groups. I've never seen an issue, a foreign policy issue, so subject to total misinterpretation and misrepresentation.
Yeah. Well, Barry Rubin,
so
we know
what their goals are.
Yeah, as you know, here in the United States, we've had the Director of National Intelligence, top intelligence officer in the country, assure us that the Muslim Brotherhood is a largely secular group that has eschewed violence. So we've got denial going on. It's willful blindness in the extreme. I have to leave it at that. I'm sorry,
okay.
We're just out of time, but this is a terrific
entry
point for a further conversation with you. Thank you for the superb work you're doing at the Gloria Center.
Thank you.
And please come back to us soon, because we're going to need to be tracking closely what is going down, but not just in Turkey, but elsewhere in the Middle East, notably in Egypt. And we appreciate your insights into all of this. Next up, we will be talking with Senator Jim DeMint, as advertised, about the Great American Awakening and what it means for you. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hey, parents. Finding it hard to communicate with kids in today's world of ever-changing slang?
Hi, son.
Excuse me?
Introducing the Communicizer. Just strap non-toxic Communicizer to your mouth and go from boring old man speak...
Oh, you know, I'm here if you want to talk.
To 100% off the chain.
Text me whenever, yo.
It's that easy.
Thanks to Communicizer, I'm relevant to my kids again. I mean, I'll fly, boo.
And now when you buy Communicizer, you get the auto-tune attachment free. Sounds so hip-hop, your kids will want to talk to you for hours.
I used to have to walk 3 miles uphill to school every morning, shorty.
I love you, Dad.
I love you too, son.
Communicizer is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org.
A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Adopt Us Kids and the Ad Council.
For decades, the Democratic Republic of Congo has endured economic collapse, poverty, and war. More than 3.5 million people have died in the conflict. Today, rebel forces continue to wreak havoc in the eastern Kivu provinces. The International Rescue Committee estimates that 30,000 children have been recruited as soldiers, and thousands more have lost their parents. Most of these children lack the most basic level of goods, security, and most especially, clean drinking water. Yet, there is a well of hope coming to eastern Congo in a village called Uvira. Washington, D.C.'s National Community Church is partnering with Global Outreach to bring a water pipeline to the Congo for Christ compound, an orphanage for children who have lost their parents to war and AIDS. Building a clean water source will sustain the school, provide for the children, and hundreds more in the village. Go to www.waterforcongo.com. Learn about the work of Global Outreach and give. You can be part of the community in Uvira, and like a well, you can be a source of hope in life. www.waterforcongo.com.
Hi, I'm Drew Brees, NFL quarterback for the New Orleans Saints, here with Bugs Bunny to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you fuel your body and your mind.
So what do you like to throw around the football like Drew?
Skateboard.
Play frisbee in the park.
Ride a bike.
Kick the soccer ball around.
Or dance in your room.
Just move it your way.
Because nothing makes you feel better than moving every day.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
So be a player.
You'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
Move it your way and be a player.
Get up and play an hour a day, Doc. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
That's right, at letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
Following is an important message from President Clinton and President Bush.
In January, Haiti experienced an environmental catastrophe and human tragedy of epic proportion.
But thanks in part to the generous spirit of the American people, the country of Haiti has survived. But now the people need to thrive. President Clinton and I have seen firsthand the power of your contributions at work.
The Clinton-Bush Haiti Fund is on the ground, funding programs that create jobs, teach skills, and assist local businesses.
Our fund is dedicated to supporting initiatives that encourage local entrepreneurs and help build an inclusive economy that lifts up everyone.
Help us continue this work so the people of Haiti have an opportunity to prosper.
Thank you.
To donate, go to ClintonBushHaitiFund.org or text QUAKE to 20222 to give $10. Message and data rates may apply. Brought to you by the Clinton Bush Haiti Fund and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are joined by one of the most impressive younger members of the United States Senate. He is Senator Jim DeMint from South Carolina. He has been serving in the Senate since 2004, and I think it's fair to say there are a few people who've done more to shake the place up in a relatively short period of time than has Senator DeMint. He's been an unstinting advocate for conservative principles in that body, and it's frequently caused some upset within his own party leadership as well as across the aisle. But it's, I think, by and large, been for very good reasons and for a very good effect. And Senator DeMint, we're delighted to welcome you to Secure Freedom Radio once again to talk about a new book you've written on some of the thinking you've been doing that animates much of this upsetting work that you're doing in the Senate and across the country. You've just published it in a new book entitled The Great American Awakening, 2 Years That Changed America, Washington, and Me. Tell us about it.
Well, Frank, thank you for the opportunity to talk about it. Thank you for what you do. One of the things I talk about in the book is the importance of talk radio, internet, and alternative communications, and getting out the word and getting people more informed and engaged. But the Great American Awakening is about the 2 years from the time Obama was elected until the last election. And as a matter of fact, it goes through the lame duck Congress. But we talk about what happened around the country with the Tea Party movement, the town halls, all the citizen activism, the rallies in Washington. And what I do is, while I talk about that, I pull back the curtain and let people see behind the scenes of what really was going on inside the Senate. Because while people on the outside were getting engaged and sometimes outraged, I was doing things to try to change rules inside the Senate, to try to ban earmark, to elect new senators like Rand Paul and Marco Rubio and Pat Toomey. None of this went well with the old party establishment. So I was an outcast for the last couple of years in Washington, but outside of Washington, I was joining millions of Americans who felt the same way I did. And that's the story of how important it is to have Americans active in the process, and how their citizen activism can change Washington and change America. And that's what the story is. But the real point of the book is not the last 2 years, but the next 2 years and what we have to do to turn things around. And the last two chapters of the book about what we have to do to turn our country away from this fiscal and economic cliff.
Let's talk a little bit about the next 2 years, Senator. As you mentioned, one of the things that you've done that definitely sort of ran afoul of the normal order of things was to go out and both solicit and underwrite, to some extent, the candidacies of people who were going to be coming to Washington with very much your sense of the priorities of deficit reduction, of more responsible government, of maintaining our sovereignty, of preserving, I like to think, our national security as well. What is your expectation for the role you'll be playing in the next 2 years, both in the Senate and in that same vein, on the hustings or supporting those who are on the hustings to change Washington further in 2012?
Well, Frank, I think the critical thing for all of us to understand is this is no longer a matter of just political or ideological preference. This is a matter of national survival. Balancing the budget is not a conservative idea. It is an essential idea to if we're going to save our country. If we're drowning in debt, the first thing you have to do is stop spending more than you're bringing in. This is not something that many in Washington seem to understand. But what I hope to do is more of what I did in 2010 is the Senate Conservatives Fund, which is my political action committee. It doesn't do what other political action committees do. I'm not supporting incumbents. What I'm doing is going across the country and trying to identify good conservative Republicans running in primaries and see if I, along with thousands of Americans, can help them win. And what I found is if we can get good candidates and put them on this website, which, by the way, is SenateConservatives.com, when we put Marco Rubio on the website and he was 30 points behind in the polls to a popular incumbent governor, people all over the country started sending in checks for $10 or $20. And before it was all over, we had raised nearly $1 million for that one candidate and $9 million in total for candidates like Pat Toomey and Rand Paul, Mike Lee, Ron Johnson, who were running against the establishment, in effect. And there are 23 Democrats up this time, and I want to do the same thing we did last time. But the point of the Great American Awakening is I have no power at all unless I'm standing with millions of Americans who feel the same way. And so what I'm trying to do, and I know these new Republicans are trying to do, is to be a voice for those Americans who are concerned and fearful about the future of our country, and they want to do their part to turn things around. And so that's what we're going to continue to do, is be a voice of reason for the American people and try to get 5 or 10 more solid common sense conservatives who will stand up for those principles that made this country exceptional.
We're speaking again with Senator Jim DeMint of South Carolina, author of an important new book entitled The Great American Awakening, 2 Years That Changed America, Washington, and Me. Senator, we have spoken in the past from time to time about what I consider a very important conservative value and touchstone for, I hope, the sorts of people that you're electing to office, namely an issue that, of course, is the principal focus of this program, securing our freedom. I know you are very insistent that we must make economies in defense as elsewhere, particularly where there is wastefulness or fraud or abuse or that sort of thing. We've been speaking in the segment prior to yours with Cliff May of the Foundation for Defense of Democracy, doing sort of a stock-taking on the condition of the world, and it's not a pretty picture. And I wonder, having heard you say repeatedly that we have to be mindful that, you know, you can't have a great military if you don't have a great economy, isn't there a risk, Senator DeMint, that we run of having neither a great military or a great economy, because without a great military, we may well have very dire things happen to our economy. Sea lanes of commercial transit and so on being affected, just as one example. And I just wonder, are you concerned as this super committee proceeds with its work that we may find draconian cuts being made that in fact jeopardize the overall well-being of the country as well as our national security?
Well, Frank, I very much am. The way this super committee was set up, it's going to present Republicans with two alternatives. One is to raise taxes, and the other is to cut our defense. I don't think we're going to have good choices here. And I'm not sure what we're going to do with this. There are obviously some savings we can make in the Pentagon. We know there's some waste, but we need to understand that everything we have is dependent on our ability to defend ourselves and our interest around the world. And peace and stability is really going to come through American strength. Ronald Reagan understood that. Few other presidents have understood it in the same way. And so it is something I think we need to continue to be committed to. We need to rethink our role in the world. I frankly think we have to recognize with our fiscal condition that we can no longer be the world's policeman. We cannot be the world's sugar daddy. So we have to pick our spots and be much smarter about what we do. And our military has to be smart, lean, strong, the highest technology in the world, and we need to make sure that every man and woman that we send out to fight has the best equipment, the best protective gear, the best technology of any army in the world. But we cannot do that unless we make it a commitment, and that's going to require funding, there's certainly waste. I'm just afraid if we arbitrarily cut defense that at the same time we're cutting our commitment to defense, and I don't believe that there are a lot of Democrats who are really committed to the need for us to have the strongest military in the world.
I'm afraid you're right about all of those concerns. Senator Jim DeMint, thank you so much for joining us, and again, best of luck with the new book and with the mission you're on to try to ensure that we are well represented in the United States Senate and well led there and elsewhere in Washington. We look forward to your visits in the future, and keep up the great work in the meantime. Next up, we will be talking with Gordon Chang about what is happening in Asia, which bears on all of what the senator has just said. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I went from a size 18 down to a size 5, and I was able to keep it off.
Angie had some serious challenges.
I had gone through a divorce and put on quite a bit of weight. There was an accident where I was put on a lot of medications, and I put on over 60 pounds. I tried every kind of diet, but diets just did not work.
Diets don't work is something they hear a lot over at the MetaSystem from Judy Singer.
I heard about Judy Singer's MetaSystem, and I thought, well, you know, couldn't hurt to call, and I called them up, and they told me all about the product, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. From the first week that I was on it, I wasn't hungry a lot, and it was just amazing. Jumping about 3 months ahead, I dropped 63 pounds.
If you're ready for a natural product that cleanses your system and helps you lose fat, talk to a Judy Singer counselor about the MetaSystem. Call 1-800-711-JUDY. 1-800-711-JUDY. The MetaSystem from Judy Singer. Powerful, all-natural weight loss. 1-800-711-JUDY.
Hi. This is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real special forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a non-profit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home was built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Dennis Prager thinks there should be a simple standard to textbooks.
I'll tell you how I think a textbook should be written. This is what happened. Period.
That is the role of the text.
And if nearly everybody who did something important in American history, if 78.9% of them were WASP males, then I want 78.9% of the textbook to reflect that fact.
I care about truth.
That's why I'm not on the left.
The Dennis Prager Show. Weeknights at 10 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone. At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home,
or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org. Even if it's just everyday stuff, like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really?
What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined as we are each week, I'm very pleased to say, by Gordon Chang, our duty expert here at Secure Freedom Radio when it comes to matters involving the Asian sphere. He is actually also a go-to guy for a number of other outfits, including Fox News and Forbes.com, which publishes a column by Gordon. And Gordon, there's, as ever, much afoot in your neck of the woods, notably the arrival imminently of the Vice President of the United States, Joe Biden, in China. What's he going for, and what do you expect to come out of the conversation?
Yeah, the Vice President is leaving Washington on Tuesday. I think the Chinese are looking at this as an opportunity for them to lecture the United States about debt. That's the way they're going to portray it. Biden, however, is going to go to talk about security issues, South China Sea, North Korea, and especially Taiwan, because of the impending arms package. And he wants to make sure that the Chinese are not going to sort of break off military relations. You know, these military relations benefit the Chinese much more than us, so I don't think we should be too concerned when, you know, Beijing walks away in a huff.
Gordon, tell us what we know about these Taiwanese arms purchases. This has been kicking around for a long time. Our colleague Bill Gertz has told us that there are one or more individuals in the in the National Security Council that are dead set against anything that would possibly upset the Chinese, including selling them military equipment to Taiwan. Is this going to amount to much, this arms sale? And if the Chinese do vehemently oppose these military-to-military talks and so on, will it cause the United States to back away?
Basically, the State Department and some people in the White House have opposed arms packages to Taiwan. In 2006, Taiwan asked to buy 66 F-16s of the C to D variant. And these are pretty modern planes and certainly could help Taiwan. The administration is not going to sell new planes. What they will do is they will retrofit one of Taiwan's two wings of the A to B version of the plane. They're going to sell enhanced radars, electric countermeasure pods, some engine upgrades, and there's probably going to be a few other aspects to it. But clearly, this is not enough because the Chinese have been rapidly increasing their air force and their ability to attack Taiwan. We need to sell the Taiwanese all that they're willing to buy. And clearly, this is a case where Taiwan is so important for defense of Japan, our cornerstone ally in Asia. So we need to be on top of this. And unfortunately, the administration is backing down, fearing the Chinese reaction.
Well, and that reaction has been telegraphed, as we talked about last week, Gordon, the extent to which the Chinese Communist Party uses its publications as mouthpieces for the party line, as they say. And there's a warning that the Chinese may downgrade their purchases of the U.S. Treasury instruments if this time we see the Taiwan arms sales going forward. And I think the quote is, they believe that limited trade sanctions, unquote, should be launched against states whose representatives in Congress support Taiwan. Do you see it actually playing out that way?
I know the Chinese are blustering right now, and they may actually try to impose some sort of penalties. In February 2010, when the Obama administration announced a stripped-down arms package, China threatened all sorts of financial sanctions. They didn't go through with them. This time, they have talked about using their purchases of Treasury obligations as a quote-unquote financial weapon. I don't think that they can do so, but even if they did, it would be okay, because our problem has always been that too many people around the world have been willing to lend us money, not too few. If the Chinese walk away, others will buy treasuries. We have to remember that last week, in all the turmoil in the global markets because of Standard & Poor's downgrade, treasury obligations were still very, very popular, almost as popular as gold and Swiss francs. So let's not worry about what the Chinese say. Let's do what we need to do. And what we need to do is support Taiwan.
Yeah. Speaking of allies in the Western Pacific, Gordon, as we discussed over the past 2 weeks, you were recently down under visiting Australia. And I wanted to explore with you a little bit further the extent to which China is making a strategic play in Australia, not only to enhance its economic presence and involvement there, but also with perhaps the view of trying to wean or otherwise fracture the Australian alliance with the United States. Is that something we should, in fact, be concerned about?
We need to be definitely concerned about it, because basically Beijing has been doing, as you said, it's been trying to use its economic leverage and other levers of power to pry Australia away from the alliance with the United States. Now, the government in Australia, in Canberra, has, you know, really close ties to the United States. And those were during the period of John Howard. And those carried over to his two predecessors, Kevin Rudd and now Julia Gillard.
His successors.
But nonetheless, we really need to work on this, because the Chinese are working overtime to try to influence Australian public opinion. They do that through a number of ways, by threatening, by blustering, by using economic incentives. So this is not a done deal in terms of the U.S.-Australian relationship. We need to work at it. And that's the message that I got when I was down there.
Yeah. Well, I certainly second that sentiment, and pleased that you're pushing that line now that you're back. Gordon, there's been a report of sea trials of the new Chinese aircraft carrier. I don't think a week goes by where we're not sort of doing some stock taking about what China is up to in the South China Sea. Talk to us about both the evidence of the increasing aspiration of the Chinese military to be able to project power with these carriers and through other means throughout a region that they're, or a body of water that they're now calling their own. And secondly, if you would, describe whether, in your expectation, we'll hear Vice President Biden remonstrating with the Chinese that they are not living up to their obligations under the Law of the Sea Treaty, which the administration tells us is going to be the panacea to Chinese claims to have that entire body of water and to exclude others, including our Navy.
China just completed the sea trials for its first carrier, and clearly nations in the region are extremely worried. We've had a number of statements from countries in the region, such as Taiwan and now South Korea, about anti-carrier weapons. But the most important thing is for the United States to maintain a very clear stance on what's going on, because if we are able to convince the Chinese that their adventurism in the South China Sea will not pay off, then Beijing will not challenge us. But if we show any signs of weakness, that's a real problem. And I think that Vice President going to Beijing is in itself a sign of weakness. The Chinese should be coming to Washington to talk to Biden, not the other way around. Every time we have an administration, you know, the U.S. president goes to China first, and then the Chinese president comes to Washington. We need to reverse that, because in the Chinese view of things, that is basically our showing our subservience to Beijing. We need to stop this. And the South China Sea is a very important issue. Yes, we need to talk to the Chinese about it, but we should talk to them in Washington, not in Beijing.
Yeah. Gordon Chang, as you know, there's the tradition of kowtowing to the Chinese emperor, and I'm sure that that's how they're perceiving this when we make these sorts of trips. Let me ask you about one other thing that may be on the vice president's agenda, and that is the prospect that on the eve of a major push by the Obama administration to get the Senate to ratify a very controversial treaty known as the Law of the Sea Treaty, that Biden will feel obliged to remonstrate with the Chinese over their failure as members, as parties to that treaty, to live up to the limitations on what they can claim as territorial waters, that is to say, not the entire South China Sea. Do you expect that to be on Biden's agenda?
The Law of the Sea Treaty very well may come up in discussions in Beijing. This is something that the United States needs to push back on. You know, the Chinese have signed the treaty, but, you know, their territorial claims are inconsistent with the fundamental structure of that treaty. Biden needs to point that out. We need to be talking to the Chinese that we're not going to sign that treaty, but if the Chinese are members of the treaty, they've got to adhere to its provisions. Too often, you know, we allow the Chinese to sign things up, bilateral agreements, international agreements, and the Chinese just go out and violate them, and we don't say anything about that. That's happening right now. We need to have a firm stance on all of these issues. And the South China Sea, where a conflict could easily break out, is something where really Washington needs to exert leadership to maintain peace in East Asia. Because if there is conflict there, it's going to involve many nations, and it will involve the United States.
Gordon Chang, I can't agree more with your assessment and your warnings. We'll be following these things closely with you, as we do all the time here at Secure Freedom Radio. Thanks for joining us. Keep up the great work, and we'll talk with you again next week. That's all for today. Thanks for joining us. I hope you'll do so again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.